invitation to deliver a talk here at Perimeter Institute. When I was very young, I believed in Dirac, and I believed that I was going to be able to quantize gravity. So I believed in loop quantum gravity, and I looked a lot at what people did back then here at Perimeter in that stuff. Now I still believe in Dirac, but I don't believe I will quantize gravity, so I look at the quantum information group more closely. But Perimeter has been important for a long time for me for different reasons. So today I'm going to tell you about some work I did in Indiana on dualities. Of course, dualities are just a tool, so you don't study them just for the sake of studying them. You want to learn things about phase diagrams and other stuff. But we did find a new way to look at dualities, and it turns to be very well suited to attack problems with topological quantum order. I'm not going to argue to you today that that's because the way we propose to study quantum dualities handles gauge symmetries really well. So I'm going to start with some loose motivation. Then I'm going to introduce the main technical tool, these Bohn algebras that are in some loose sense algebras of interactions. I'm going to explain the connection of Bohn algebras to dualities. And then I'm going to discuss some very simple examples that illustrate a circle of ideas that connects dualities, confinement in some simple models at topological quantum order. And I'm going to give you this simple, please keep in mind that I want to illustrate the technique. So I'm just going to show you the simplest examples and then give you those nasty slides with list of the interesting results. But if you, there is something you especially want to see, ask me, and I have other slides prepared. Then I'm going to switch gears a little bit. I'm going to argue that dualities are a good way to think about exact dimensional reduction. But once you accept that, you realize fairly soon that exact dimensional reduction is a very delicate phenomenon and depends on very special things. So you want some notion on effective dimensional reduction or approximate, and I'm going to propose a way to get a quantitative estimate on some form of effective dimensional reduction. That's newer work, and you know, we are still thinking about it, but we think the mathematical results we have are interesting. Okay, that's not what I want at all. Okay, let's see. Yeah, that's much better. Okay, motivation. I like this quotation from Maxwell. Instead of using the analogy of heat, a fluid, the properties of which are entirely at our disposal, is assumed as the vehicle of mathematical reasoning. The mathematical ideas obtained from the fluid and then applied to various parts of electrical science. People in that time thought a lot about analogies. Analogies are very important in physics. And analogies appear basically because when you find out an analogy, you're emphasizing the structure of your physical laws rather than the elementary degrees of freedom. If you stop thinking that your vector potential phi or something is the potential for the electric field, and just look at the equations it satisfies, well, then you start to find analogies with fluid mechanics. The way to do that is you have to forget about the specific meaning of the elementary degree of freedom and just think about the rules it follows. This is Maxwell's dog, by the way. People don't usually show Maxwell's dog, so I thought I should do that today. So our philosophy, inspired a little bit by that, is that interactions are more important than elementary degrees of freedom. Of course, that depends on the problem you want to tackle. But for many problems, it's a fairly useful way to think. But you need to turn that philosophy into some mathematical tool. You can't just have a philosophy and talk about it. You need to be able to do something about it. So one way we propose to implement this philosophy is as follows. OK, so how do you build a model in quantum mechanics? You start by specifying some elementary degrees of freedom, and then you figure out what are the basic interactions. Then you put the basic interactions together, and that's your Hamiltonian. Once you have your Hamiltonian, you're actually very interested in see what new degrees of freedoms emerge from the low energy subspace of that Hamiltonian. So people typically think a lot about this. For instance, quantum statistics is encoded there. And they think a lot about this, especially lately. And this is what we have to look at. But people don't really pay that much attention to this. These are dictated by symmetry. We are used to write them almost by heart. So we don't think that much about those, really. So what do I mean by this abstract notation? Here is a concrete example. Imagine I have a chain of spins. Each side in the chain has a Pauli degree of freedom. Then if I want to study an easy model, these are the interactions I propose to study. When I put them together with suitable couplings, I get the easy model. And there is a phase of the easy model where the relevant emergent degree of freedom are kinks, or these domain words. So one difference between EDFs, or in particular fermions, for instance, and these guys, is that these guys are always sparse. When you just look at the interactions can't anti-commute like fermions at long distances. They have typically to commute in general, except for very specific other interactions. And that's a reflection of locality. Yes. Just this in this example.
So you this is a. The three-body terms and the things that are not bonds.
Right, right. What I'm going to call bond is just whatever atomic piece you want to put in your Hamiltonian, whatever basic interaction that you then add to get your Hamiltonian. And they are not unique, you know? They are not.
So you're not limiting yourself
to no, no. In no way, this is just an example. This is just an example. Okay, so when I ask what are the elementary degrees of freedom, in quantum mechanics, what I'm really asking is what is the algebra of the elementary degrees of freedom? So let's take that as an inspiration to study interactions in their own sake. So let us propose the following. When we ask what are the interactions, what we're really asking is what is the algebra of interactions? And maybe this is an interesting thing to study. And that's what I'm going to argue today, that this is an interesting object to study. So let me define, let me associate an algebra to all the elementary interactions. I know the elementary degrees of freedom. Those are bosons, fermions. I know those algebras. Let me now associate an algebra to elementary interactions. And so I'm going to define this Bohn algebra, which is just the algebra generated by all these elementary interactions with some technical condition that is useful. So let's take a closer look at this creature. The idea is that I want to put my elementary interactions, embed them in a bigger set that is closed under multiplication, that is closed under addition, that is closed under Hermitian conjugation, and satisfies some other technical condition that's empty if my system is finite dimensional, if my Hilbert space is finite dimensional. So basically, I'm thinking about all linear or finite linear combination of all this type of products. And it's important to have closure under Hermitian conjugation. So as one way to implement our philosophy, focus on the interactions, we propose that to learn something about this, we need to, we can study these Bohn algebras and learn some useful things. That's my proposal. That's what I need to prove to you that it works. So we have been doing that for a while, focusing on Bohn algebras. And these are the things that work out best. Dualities, by far. The best developed application of Bonnard algebras is in the study of quantum dualities. Most of this talk is going to be about that, so I'm not going to tell you too much about that right now. But regrettably, I'm not going to have time to show you how classical dualities work in this framework. One of the nicest things about looking at dualities through the eyes of Bonnard algebras is that you get a unified approach to quantum and classical dualities. But I'm going to focus on quantum today. And if any of you want to hear about classical, then please ask me at the end of the talk. Topological degrees of freedom, this non-local collective modes that can control interesting phases, can be derived in a certain sense that I'm going to illustrate soon. Dualities can give you symmetries of phase diagrams. And the main point of my talk is that I can use this type of dualities to get a very interesting connection between gate theories and some models of topological quantum order. And it's going to be the basis, like I were telling you, of my approach to exact dimensional reduction. We get some nice insight into fermionization. I'm going to talk about this. And we get some very nice exact solutions of some models of some interesting models of topological quantum order. I'm not going to talk about this. This is a work I was not really involved with. So we have Hamiltonians. We identify these elementary interactions, and we associate algebras to them. What can we do next? Well, we know how to compare algebras really well. We have to find mappings that connect the elements in both algebras and preserves the operations in the algebra. So I'm going to propose the following definition. I'm going to say that two Hamiltonians, quantum Hamiltonians, are dual if their Bonnard algebras are isomorphic, and if the isomorphism that takes that connects the two Bonnard algebras takes one of the Hamiltonians to the other. It's a definition. Those of you who are not familiar with the historical approach to dualities will see as we proceed what is the connection. Those of you who are not familiar to the historical approach, just take this as the starting point and try. You know, you can decide if you like dualities or not. So dualities are unitary transformations. This is a very immediate consequence of demanding that Bonnard algebras be von Neumann, and basically because of we ask that the algebra be closed on the Hermitian conjugation, and that basically makes things so strong that I can essentially find a unitary transformation that implements my mapping. Typically, this is a technicality. Those of you who like quantum information and are familiar with Stein-Sprint theorem will recognize this as a relative of Stein-Sprint theorem. But typically, you can ignore the one. So dualities are unitary equivalences. I have two Hamiltonians, and I have this contrived way to look for unitary equivalence between the two. Now, let me show you one simple but interesting insight I get from this point of view. Very simple models. Fermions hopping on the line and DHY model. Now, I know, everybody knows, that DHY model is exactly solvable because there is a non-local transformation that maps this guy to this guy. This non-local transformation was found by Jordan and Bigner. It's a very ingenious transformation that tells you how to write fermions in terms of spins. Now, if I now forget about the Jordan-Bigner transformation and try to look at the Bonnard algebras of these models, I can figure out fairly easily that they are isomorphic, and that this is the mapping that connects the two. The elementary degrees of freedom have very different statistics, but the interactions are the same. Yes, sorry.
Is that a duality morphism? Does locality play a role? I mean, do you require to go from local operators to local operators, or is that not a
remember that I put the Hamiltonians in my definition. The starting point are two physical Hamiltonians. So my mapping, the constraint, what is this constraint? Well, among other things, this constraint tells me that for some combination of degrees of freedom here, this map has a local effect. Because in the end, what I get on this side is a local Hamiltonian.
But the mapping doesn't mean local.
No.
Just like an example you just showed.
That's right. It's wait till the next transparency. You'll see where I'm going with this. So yeah, this mapping is local in these operators. It's local in the generators of my Born algebra. Okay. So they are dual in the sense of my definition. People don't typically think of this as a duality, but it fits my definition. And now I want to make the following interesting computation. What is the effect of my mapping on the elemental degrees of freedom? I know it's local on the interactions, almost by construction. That's the way I look for them. I have the interactions on both sides, and I just to see if I can map one set of interactions into the other. But what if I try to extend the mapping to the local degrees of freedom? Then things get a little bit more complicated. I need to work a little bit harder. First, my mapping is only defined on interactions, so I need to, on the Born algebra, so I need to enlarge the Born algebra a little bit to make sure that the elementary fermions are also in the algebra. The algebra generated by these guys, strictly speaking, cannot possibly contain these operators because this algebra commutes with number conservation of fermions. All these bilinears preserve fermion number. I'm saying here preserves sigma C component momentum. These guys don't commute with the total number operator, so it can't possibly be in this algebra. But if I extend my algebra just by adding this boundary term, then I can compute all the other guys in terms of that boundary term and my interactions. And then I can extend my duality mapping just by saying how it acts on that boundary term, making sure that that extension preserves all the algebraic relations. And now I can use this ingredient and this ingredient to compute the action of my duality mapping on any of the elementary fermions. And this is how I recover the well-loved Jordan-Bigner transformation. It's a local approach to the Jordan-Bigner transformation, if you want. The Jordan-Bigner transformation is not local because we are looking at the wrong degree of freedom in some sense. If you look at the interactions, then the Jordan-Bigner transformation is just the consequence of a local mapping. But it's local in the interactions.
So here, how did you discover phi d?
So this is where the how works goes. You need to characterize these algebras, typically in terms of relations. And once you are done characterizing the algebras, you try to compare the two characterizations and see basically they are isomorphic, and that typically tells you what the mapping should be.
Right, but for the case of a single Fermat.
Okay, so.
Jordan-Bigner transformation. So is it that easy, straightforward to see?
If you've been doing it for a year, like I did when I derived this particular example, I had been working with these things for a year. So yeah, it takes some practice. But yeah, once you're used to it, it's the natural way to go.
Sorry, I think I have a same question. So you are reformulating things, but at some point you say that this reformulation would lead you to the Jordan-Bigner transformation?
Right, which it has to be the case.
No, I know that the conclusion has to be the same, but did you develop a tool that would give you this Jordan-Bigner transformation?
Yeah. Imagine that you never heard about Jordan-Bigner transformation. Right. But you heard about my fancy idea. Then you look at the interactions. Yeah. You characterize these algebras,
and you see
the isomorphic. And you write down this mapping. Once you have this mapping, you can ask yourself the question, what is the action of this mapping on my elemental degrees of freedom? Because at some point I measure them. In principle, it's not defined there. Because it's not obvious that these guys are in this algebra, inside this algebra. But that's my goal. Once I have, I know they are unitary equivalent and sort of done from that point of view, but now I would like to see what do the fermions look like, the elemental fermions. So to do that, first I need to make sure that the fermions live in my one algebra so I can extend my mapping to act on them.
Originally they don't.
Are you extended? So I add this boundary correction. Typically, one little thing on the boundary will do the trick.
On the boundary of?
Boundary, loosely speaking, just. It's not that I have to add all the fermions and start all over. I just need to add this one. Okay. And once I add this one, I get all the others from an algebraic operation that involves this guy and the bonds in my Hamiltonian. So I just have to break that symmetry, that fermion number symmetry in the bond algebra, everybody jumps into the bond. So I enlarge my bond algebra by adding this guy, and in this way I get all the fermions in my bond algebra. Now, phi d is only defined on these guys from my previous slide. So now I need to see if I can extend, this is like an analytic continuation, if I can extend this guy to this new generator and preserve all the algebraic relations. If I cannot extend it and preserve the algebraic relation, then I cannot extend the map. But in this case, this extension preserves all the algebraic relations. Sorry? No, it's not unique.
So you're just picking the right one in order to get the Jordan Bigner?
It's very constrained. It's very, well, no, because the Jordan Bigner is up to FA, it's up to the textbook, you know, every kind of, sorry.
I think our question is, do you have an algorithm that will produce this extension of the map? Or is it just by trial and error?
It's not trial and error. It's just that when you work with these algebras, you know, you get a feeling for them. So yeah, OK. Is it trial and error or not? Is it thematic? Is something I can program in my computer? Not really. No, I don't know how. But
for example, if you think about two dimensions,
OK.
You will discover that there are so many ways of doing it. You may not discover Jordan Bigner in
dimensions. Right. As you go up in
dimensions, there is a natural.
As you go in dimensions, it's going to be harder to find to match the algebras of interactions. Once you match the algebras of interactions, I would say this next step is not difficult. It's a bias because I'm used to it. But the hard step is to characterize the bond algebras and match them. Sorry.
I mean, it's not necessarily possible that extension
exists. It's not necessarily possible. For instance, if I have gauge symmetries, I cannot extend my mapping to operators that are not gauge invariant. We're going to see an example of that. This is a very nice picture. Exactly. It's not obvious that you can. But you can. And once you realize you can, the trick is to apply this mapping to this recursive relation. And once you do that, you know what this is. This is this operator. And suppose you set this to 1, then here I get sigma 1 minus. Here I get the image. No, that's not right. 2. Suppose I set I equal to 2. Then I get that the image of the fermion number 2 is the image of the fermion number 1, this guy, times the image of this interaction, which I know. And so I can compute the image of fermion number 2, which is going to be minus sigma C1 times sigma minus 2. And so I can go on all these relations and get my dual fermion. This one? Again, you need to, it comes from working with the previous algebra. When you work with the previous one, you characterize it, you know, you make friends with it, and you get the intuition to do these things.
So, just guess, right? The first step. This one, C1 goes to C1.
Right? Yes.
So it's just a guess.
It's just a case?
A guess.
No, no, it's not a guess. You know your algebra, so you know that just anything won't do. You know your algebra. You won't just propose C1 goes to whatever because you know right away, because you know your algebra, that most things won't work. This is an almost natural consequence of understanding your algebra of interactions. There are many constraints that you already understand. So it's not a guess. It's a very educated guess, extremely educated guess. If you want.
Sorry, I'm just trying to get back.
Yeah.
So you're saying if you guess properly how C1 transforms it?
It's a very educated guess.
If you guess that one right,
yeah.
Then the rest follows?
The rest follows automatically. That's what I'm trying to explain here.
And is this the strength of the approach? That if you get the first one right, you get the rest automatically?
Well, the strength of the approach is that it gives you topological excitation out of local mappings. That's the way we see it. You have these local mappings, and then you can derive these non-local excitations that have simple energetics because the dual Hamiltonian constrains those energetics. So it tells you, it allows you to compute this. For this spin system, one way to look at this is, okay, this tells me that fermions are topological collective excitations of spins, and I can derive that from the interactions.
This was your simplest example.
Yeah.
And that's, so do we take this and then we'll see that, or you can apply it in more difficult cases, and again, you'll have to have an educated guess, make an educated
at the boundary,
guess.
Yes.
The boundary,
at the boundary,
the
yes. Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yes.
So if I understand, because in this example, you get the rational argument by just adding C1, right?
Right.
But in principle, you should add whatever is outside of the commutator.
Right. Right.
So it might be. So just in this case, this one propagates and reproduces all
right.
the
right.
complement to the commutator.
Right.
The more complicated examples would be less.
Yeah, but typically these algebras are very large. I mean, these are not simple algebras because they are small. On the contrary, they are very large. When you just take whatever combination of bonds, typically you get almost a full matrix algebra. The almost is these symmetries. If you have some symmetries of your Hamiltonian that commute with every bond, then you can have some operators outside your bond algebra. But there are typically only a few operators. There are many, many examples of many levels of complexity. We don't know any examples where it doesn't boil down the boundary term.
What do you mean by experience for the models that you tried, or do you have some? Because in principle, it seems to me that the complement to the commutant is arbitrarily large.
Right. Yeah, no, I don't have a general theory and guarantee you how big it is. Yeah. Our most mathematical collaborator wants to do things along those lines, and we are trying to resist because it can be hard to sell to physicists. So, you know, if you like to think like string nets and how to get particles to emerge from something else, I like to think of this as a toy sample of that idea, because if I could somehow find physical principle to specify this algebra of interactions, then the fermions and the spins would emerge just from looking for local representations of that algebra. So, you know, if you really want to push this idea that interactions are more important, then in some sense you can even derive elementary degrees of freedom. Okay. So since I started with this example, let me tell you what can we do with this, for fermionization in particular. So what I was telling you just now, it has the flavor of this program of deriving elementary excitations from string nets or things like that. You know the Jordan-Mien transformation in any dimension. There is no need to derive it in this way. But you can do it if you like the physical picture. Now, if you use other dualities, that's useful. For example, the models that cannot be fermionized in their original presentation, you can sometimes find a duality and then fermionize the dual representation. The dual representation is unitarily equivalent. So you're basically fermionizing the original model you want to study. For example, the Ising model in two dimensions in the transverse field, it can be fermionized at this distance. But you can make a duality and fermionize the dual model. It's a sample here.
then you don't get
right, you get local constraints, it's true. The model you fermionize is a model with gauge symmetries in the end. So you map the easy mo- sorry? Right. Okay, I insist, I'm just gonna tell you the elementary examples because I want you to see the math at work, and then I'm gonna tell you the non-trivial applications. So easy model. Let's look at the algebra of interactions of the easy model. This is what makes contact with history, if you know the history. Now, to characterize this algebra, I can make this nice little table, and I need to argue that that's all I need to characterize my algebra. So this guy anticommutes with two neighbors, this guy anticommutes with these two neighbors, and this square to one. So you see right away there is some sort of symmetry of interactions here at play. And indeed, you can find this mapping that preserves all the algebraic relations. This tells you right away that the easy model with these couplings is dual, unitarily equivalent, to the easy model with its change couplings, giving you the symmetry of the spectrum that allows you to locate the transition line on this here, 45 degrees, without solving it exactly. It's an exactly solvable model. This is a fast way to see where the transition line is. That's one of the main strengths of dualities, finding symmetry lines on phase diagrams. Now, how do I get the historical non-local change of variables? Well, I play the same game. I need to extend the action of my mapping to the elemental degrees of freedom. And here, if I just allow myself to be a little bit sloppy, I can just write this spin as this infinite string of interactions and get this dual image for this elemental degree of freedom. These are the topological, what the so-called topological excitations of the easy model. The easy model has a phase that is ordered ferromagnetically, and it has a disorder phase where these non-local excitations are ordered. You have this king condensate. So this is what we like. This is something we like a lot about this approach. We derive topological excitations from local mappings, from interactions. We are looking at the interactions. So let me advertise a little bit some more complicated work I did along these lines. The dualities are not new here, but there are some new results. The Picklock model that in lattice field theory is called the CP Higgs field, or also the vector pots model, is self-dual for any P. This is a, you know, the easy model is a C2 model. There are CP generalizations that are self-dual for any P. But notice the following. We have shown that if P is greater or equal to 3, the model has a non-abelian group of global symmetries. So we have non-abelian symmetries and self-duality. That's something that you don't see in the literature as something possible. People will tell you non-abelian dualities are difficult. And what is a non-abelian duality? It's a duality for a model with non-abelian symmetry. Well, this seems to be a counterexample. This model has a Costelli-Fourier transition, and that's weird because this model has only discrete symmetries. So there has to be an emergent continuous symmetry, and there is one, but to the best of our knowledge, we are the first one to be able to write it explicitly. We actually managed to write this emergent, the operator form of this emergent U symmetry that allows you to understand the BKT transition in this model. Frohlich did some very difficult estimates to show that in the 80s. And he was the one that said, Frohlich and Spencer. They said, there is an emergent U1 symmetry. We can see it in the measure of our partition function, but we don't know how to write it explicitly. And it remained kind of an open question. What is that emergent continuous symmetry? And when you work that problem at the quantum level, well, we finally managed to write the operator that does it. we were very, very happy with that. Well, let me move on, because this is not the focus. Unless you have questions, this is not what I want to emphasize. I don't think you guys really care about those phase transitions that much. So I'm changing the notation now to make contact with the literature, but not the model so much. Now I'm putting my spins. I have, again, a chain of spins, but my spins are on the links they live on the links. And I have this interaction between neighbor spins. I have the transverse field. I have this longitudinal field and this transverse field. So this is basically the Ising chain I looked at already with a longitudinal field. That model is no longer exactly solvable. So it's a little bit, we know the phase diagram. It's a little bit more complicated. But this really changes the rules of the game, because I know that the mapping I have already will map this guy to a non-local term. I can't use that mapping anymore. I need to look for a different duality. So I look at the Born algebra and think about it, and I find this alternative representation. If I map, now this model has something of an Ising part, and then I have a field on the links coupling to it. So this, you can think of this as a C2 Higgs model coupled to C2 electromagnetism in one dimension. In one dimension, you only have electric field. So this is the link that starts at site I and it ends at site I plus 1. It's the link that starts here and ends here. And the degree of freedom lives here.
So can you go back?
Yeah. So now I'm writing this model in terms of degrees of freedom that live on the links. So I have these sides I,
yeah,
but my degrees of freedom live on the links.
So
I have this guy interacts with this guy through this term. I have this longitudinal field and the transverse field. This is important. This is, you could think of this as the extended toric code model in one dimension. The interesting one is in two dimensions. It's the one these guys studied. But if you look at the toric code in a magnetic field in one dimension, the Plaquette operator doesn't make much sense. All you have is the star operator. So I have a sum of star operators, and I want to see how things change when I add field.
But this is the Ising model.
This is the Ising model. Yeah, you know, there are several ways to look at that model. So I want a duality for that. I need to find a different representation of the algebra of interactions.
This is an exact duality.
All of these are exact. All of these are exact.
So the part that I understand now is when you have the subscript I.
Right. So now my dual model.
Degrees of freedom on the left.
Yeah. Now I have in my dual model, I have degrees of freedom on the vertices and on the links. And if I do that, if I enlarge my set of degrees of freedom, I can find an alternative representation of those interactions. For example, this guy anti-commutes with this guy. And that's good, because this guy also anti-commutes with this guy. So we are good. But there's something weird. The algebra is right, but it looks like we have lost degrees of freedom.
Sorry. Before you do the mapping, we started with a Hamiltonian. Now the top Hamiltonian is a new one. Is that correct?
Right. This is my proposal for an exact dual Hamiltonian. So I have this Hamiltonian.
The sense spectrum will be identical.
Right. The spectra are identical, right.
The low part of the spectrum or the whole? I mean, you have more degrees of freedom, right?
Yeah. So can you hold that question one slide?
You said it has the same spectrum?
I'm going to explain on that, yeah. Up to. Okay.
Up to.
I'll tell you up to what. It's interesting.
More of the degenerates.
Okay, up to gauge symmetries.
Yes, up to gauge symmetries.
The dual model has gauge symmetries. And in the gauge invariant levels and states are the same as one plus. So we find a dual representation of the algebraic interactions, but we change the numbers of degrees of freedom, and that's confusing. So what happened? Okay, let me tell you one more thing. In the lattice field theory language, this is the C2 Higgs model coupled to C2 electromagnetism, okay? So I start with that one-dimensional toric code, and I go to this Higgs model. Okay, but what happened? What's the deal with the extra degrees of freedom? Well, we have to notice that this model has gauge symmetries. The Hamiltonian commutes with all these local operators, and a state of this model is physical only if it commutes with the gauge symmetries. So, what does the duality mapping do to my gauge symmetries? Well, if I go up and look at the mapping, it's perfectly well defined on its objects, on these objects, and it maps all the gauge symmetries to one.
Sorry, what did you just
say? If you go up to the previous slide and you look at this, the definition of this mapping, you see you can apply it to this object. It's well defined.
So what is that object? What is that object?
Right. I have a definition here. Yeah, right. So this is sigma, this is the sigma x on the side I, and this star operator is the product of the sigma x on the link on this link and this one on the neighboring links.
Okay.
So those are my
okay.
And you know how your duality acts on the product of these two. This is an interaction of your original model. So you know how your mapping acts on this one. And you know how your mapping acts on these ones too. So when you apply your mapping to your gauge symmetry, you get one. The duality has killed all the gauge symmetries. And the system without gauge symmetries is nothing else than a good representation of your gauge invariant physics. In other words, the one-dimensional extended toric code model is nothing else than the gauge-reduced version of the one-dimensional C2 Higgs model. So what about the unitary? This cannot be a unitary transformation. This is not an isomorphism. It's an homomorphism. Well, you can still show that there is something that is almost a unitary. It's a partial isometry. Your mapping still has this form, but this is not quite a unitary transformation. If you take this product, you get one on the system without gauge symmetries. But if you take the reverse product, you get the projector onto the gauge invariant state. And the beauty of it is that you never have to compute U. There is no need. If you don't, you know, if you have a need, you can compute it. But for all these applications, all I need is the algebra.
So what's
the
application?
Sorry? Next slide. So this very stupid example suggests two things. That I need to understand the connection between this notion and duality and gauge symmetries. And that there may be an interesting way to look at topological quantum order using this notion of dualities. So let's think about gauge symmetries first. Sorry?
Is gauge coupling infinite?
So the gauge fields are not dynamics.
Right.
Is it infinite gauge coupling?
I don't know.
Is it infinite gauge coupling?
Right, it's in the broken symmetry phase. Yeah, you're right. Oh. This model. Yeah, you're right. So this model is motivated by the Higgs field coupled to electromagnetism. So you have this potential. And this is actually supposed to model the phase where the field is moving on the.
Yeah, so I was asking, why is the gauge coupling for the Z2 gauge?
The gauge, this one. This is the matter field. This is the lattice form of this. this situation, square. So this plays the role of your gauge field. And these are the, I'm not satisfying you at all.
You have kinetic term for the field?
Yeah. This is my electric field. In one dimension, I don't have magnetic field. This is my electric field. This is my coupling, my gauge coupling to my matter field. And this is the kinetic term for my matter field. There is a lot of poetic license, right, going from a Hamiltonian in the continuum to this. But it's a fairly good picture. OK, so let's first clarify the issue with gauge symmetries. Gauge symmetries are local constraints. And by fiat, everything that is physical and observable commutes with gauge symmetries. Yeah. Yeah, you have to track. Yeah, you have to track the couplings, but yeah. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm mixing many languages here: condensed matter, lattice field theory.
So in 1D, it's always confined. Right?
Yeah. In 1D, if you have a longitudinal field, it's a mass gap opens. And your face is gapped all over. So, okay, so what is the phase diagram of this, not this guy, well, this guy is the same as this guy. What is the phase diagram of this guy? If this is zero, this is just an easy model. It has two phases. As soon as this shows up, this opens a mass gap.
So how do I see this from the gauge theory?
In the gauge theory language, that's the confining phase, it's disorder. Disorder is confinement.
As soon as gauge X is not
there. Right.
If it goes to infinity,
if it goes to infinity?
As soon as gauge X is
not there. It's a mass gap. You know, you just make the mass gap bigger.
Yeah, so my question is how do I see that from the gauge theory language?
So, what is that phase called in the gauge theory language? I think it would be called the confining phase. It's the disorder phase. Yeah, it is the confining phase. It's when the photon acquires mass.
So what's special about HX equals to zero?
That you have a new symmetry.
From the
theory
language.
Right.
Yeah, I'm looking at the gauge theory.
Right.
So if you go to the next slide, so something is asking, what happens in this Hamiltonian when HX is equal to zero?
They have the same gauge invariant ground state. It happens exactly when they say, if you program this guy and look for the gauge invariant ground state, or program the other guy and just look for the ground state, you get exactly the same object.
Yeah. So for HX equals zero, you have no dynamics for the gauge. Because sigma x I1, sigma z I1 up here. Once HX is zero.
Yeah, I'm running out of time. No, Professor, it's good. Can we come back?
It seems to me HX is actually inverse of the gauge coupling.
Yeah, right, 1 over g squared, right.
So HX equals to zero is actually infinite gauge coupling.
It's 1 over g squared, right? No, okay.
Sorry, HX equals zero is a zero gauge.
You have to be careful because your action has the 1/g², but when you actually compute the Hamiltonian, the coupling changes.
So HX seems to be the tension on the electric flux line.
Right.
So when you set HX equals zero, that's the zero gauge.
There's no dynamics associated with that.
That's right.
Yeah,
the electric.
That's the way I
understand it. Right. So as you make.
So usually
then there's more dynamics, there's infinite case. That's the other
I think I'm gonna go back to that after the talk. I mean, we can go back to the literature, track the names, and just read out the results. Okay, so why can we play this? Why did this happen? We were looking for a duality, and we end up destroying H symmetries. How is that possible? Well, the reason is that I'm studying algebras of bonds. Bonds are observable interactions, and they commute with gauge symmetries. So when I try to characterize my algebra of bonds in terms of relations and things like that, because every bond commutes with the gauge symmetry, bonds don't really know much about. They don't know anything about the gauge symmetry. So when I start looking for different representations of the bond algebra, since the structure of the bond algebra is fairly unconcerned with unobservable gauge symmetries, these things can happen. I can create gauge symmetries, or I can destroy them, or I can keep the status quo. So that's why. And typically, that's what happens. For instance, I can give you new dualities for the Heisenberg model in any number of dimensions in this language. But the dual model has gauge symmetries. Now, those gauge symmetries are not complicated SU2 gauge symmetries. They're simple gauge symmetries. So again, the fact that I can give you dualities for that SU2 Heisenberg model tells you that maybe the standard notion that a non-abelian duality is a duality for a model with non-abelian symmetries is not quite correct. If I do not preserve, if I introduce gauge symmetries or I destroy gauge symmetries, I do not have a unitary equivalence anymore. I have this rectangular unitary. And basically, what I do is eliminate all the states that are not gauge invariant. What about topological quantum order? The one-dimensional toric-coupled model is trivial. Nobody would even say that that has topological order. Well, as it turns out, the duality I just showed you is very robust. It generalizes to any abelian group, to any number of dimensions, and essentially to any lattice. It's almost weird. It's almost weird. Yeah, it really is. You generalize, you take the toric-coupled model, and you just change the lattice or change the group, and you can always find a duality to the corresponding Higgs model with that gauge group. So that suggests that whatever statement you make about topological quantum order in one of them has some form of image in the other. And in fact, you can, for instance, in two dimensions, you can compare the phase diagrams. I don't have the slide anymore. And you can compare that, for instance, what people call topological quantum order in the toric code in the gauge theory corresponds to the Coulomb phase, the phase where the charge are free. And things like that. In two dimensions, for instance, this duality holds for the honeycomb lattice. So if I look at the gauge theory in a honeycomb lattice, it's dual to a honeycomb toric code without gauge symmetries. And that's interesting, again, that's interesting because the dual model lives in a triangular lattice and has frustration. So when you have frustration in this, because you have frustration in the dual toric code, in the dual Higgs model, that makes you wonder about the stability of the topological phase of the hexagonal toric code. So what if G is non-abelian? That's the interesting question, actually. We don't know, unfortunately. Well, you know, I'm computing. But I don't have anything I can show you yet. What we do know is that the global symmetries of the problem are not the issue. We are convinced of that by now. It doesn't make any difference. The problem lies somewhere else. So when I say non-abelian, I mean what people call non-abelian, which are things like non-abelian gauge theories. But people will also call the Heisenberg model non-abelian, because this has this SU2 symmetry.
But how do you see it in terms of the algebra on operator?
No, we don't know. That's what we're trying to understand right now. We don't know how non-abelian is codified there. That's part of the problem. That's part of the problem. So the things we have that people may call non-abelian dualities, we don't think they are non-abelian dualities. We have our technical reasons. We think that we still have to produce a truly non-abelian duality. Presumably, it would be nice to find some of these bond algebraic dualities for an SU2H field. And so, okay. This is what people in the literature call non-abelian are models with non-abelian symmetries.
Okay.
Like the Heisenberg model that has an SU2 symmetry, or a Young-Mis field with non-abelian gauge. That's what people call non-abelian. From the point of view of dualities, they will tell you those models, we cannot find a duality for those models because they are non-abelian. What I'm arguing is that it's true, it's hard to find dualities for them, but it's not because of the symmetries. It's because of something else, which we don't quite know what is that yet.
Otherwise,
you're
saying bond algebra is more complicated for non-abelian?
It's basically that. It's just that the bond algebra is more complicated, but it's not because of the symmetries.
So why do you say that it's not because of the symmetries?
Well, because we have many examples of models with all kinds of non-abelian symmetries that admit simple dualities and useful dualities. We have dualities for the Heisenberg model. The Picklock model is a dual and it has non-abelian global symmetries. We have many examples that. Yes?
In the previous slide, you put string net models. And so.
Yeah, I'm not a specialist. I love them, but.
No, I was wondering what kind of symmetries you would expect. I mean, to apply a duality that would kind of kill the symmetry and get to the.
Right, so.
Reduce.
My comment goes to this. This is the reason I wanted to make this comment. That paper of Levine and Wen, right? They study this honeycomb, these models in honeycomb lattice. Particularly, they study gauge theories in a honeycomb lattice. So you have this honeycomb lattice. And the Hamiltonian is just, coupling and a plaquette term. Basically, you have your links living here, you have your spins living on the links, and you multiply all the spins sigma c in one plaquette, and that gives you this plaquette term. And then you have a transverse field on the links. And this model has gauge symmetries. If I take the product of these three spin sigma h, it commutes with my Hamiltonian. That's what people would call a C2 gauge theory on a honeycomb lattice.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there is this large subclass of string net models, which are actually LS gauge theories.
Right.
No doubt about that, you know, symmetries for that. I was wondering if you go beyond that.
What I think is interesting about that is that this model is dual to a model with average symmetries, which is just the AC model in a transverse field in a triangular lattice.
This is again the same argument.
Let me finish my argument. That the dual model has frustration. And we do not know almost anything about the stability of topological faces when there is frustration. There is a very nice paper by Sergei Preabi and Hastings, where they establish with fair strength that if you don't have frustration, your topological phase is stable. This model is supposed to have a very interesting topological phase in the language of net, but it's dual to a model with frustration. So
yeah.
That makes you wonder how stable
it's
that is.
Dual to a model with frustration.
Right.
The model itself
doesn't have it. Right. But the gauge invariant, the structure of the ground state energy as a function of the couplings is identical. They have the same ground state energy.
So the model itself, without external magnetic field, with external magnetic field, is the perturbation, right?
Right.
The language of ground elastics.
Right.
So the original model is not frustrated.
Right.
Okay,
right.
So enforcing that in the hypothesis of the theorem, and yet, if H is not too big, the gap is stable.
So you're arguing that we are showing it the other way around. We are saying something interesting about this in modeling a triangular lattice, maybe.
No, what I'm saying is that it's a statement that you can make because the model is frustration free. And now you're saying, oh, but it's dual to model that is not that is frustrated.
Right.
So we don't accept that. The model itself is frustration free. You can say that it's stable. So I'm just missing what point you are making. So this is the situation, right?
That is the situation, yes. Well, that depends on how much confidence you put in each step. You can say that, like you said, it means nothing. You can say maybe the duality is wrong. You can say maybe there is a weakness in Sergei Bravin and Hastings' result. You can say, you know.
Maybe
the duality is wrong. I invite you to check it on Mathematica with three spins. It works beautifully though. Okay. What is nonlinearity? We discussed that. We're probably running out of time. Okay, I'm going to stop here. The rest of my talk is on dimensional reduction, but I think I've gone over my time already. Right? Thank you. It's a very long talk. I need to fix that. So I hope I have managed to, you know, maybe some part of your brain perhaps now believes that bone algebras are interesting.
But by bone algebra, you mean
algebras
made
by the interactions. I wasn't focusing on exact solvability. There are works on exact solvability using these techniques, but I didn't do that because exactly solvable models are exactly solvable. What we want is to gain some form of non-perturbative information on the phase diagram. And typically, dualities tell you location of, tell you symmetries of the phase diagram. Typically, dualities tell you symmetries of the phase diagram, and you can constrain your phase diagram a lot. So that's what I did. I constrained the phase diagram of some interesting theories. We learn about that emergent symmetry of the Picklock model. We discovered new set dual models.
So can you give us some specific example where you have some interesting model
and this? Okay. I'm not sure what you find interesting, but. This is dimensional reduction of dualities. Let me see if I can bring your attention to something you can find interesting. Well, most people in condensed matter or people who are in magnetism, they always like the Heisenberg model duality. They think that's really surprising and interesting. This is a result I like. This fact that the toric-cold model, the standard toric-cold model gives you a gauge-free version of the Hilf model. If you take the gauge group to be the real numbers, translations, then you can take the continuum limit. And the model you get is something high energy theorists have studied, in particular Stuckelberg in the 50s. Is the so-called Stuckelberg model of mass generation. And so you see connections. This shows you connections. It shows you that there are lots of work there that you can connect in a very mathematically precise way and use and learn. I don't know, what kind of interesting result are you looking for?
Just what you said. You said you constrain the sign some
diagram, right.
So can you just show us
the Yeah, data? Sure. Yeah, let's go for the phase diagram. Okay. These are classical dualities. There is unsymmetry. Okay. This is what I used to show, the two-dimensional case. But the bone algebra is a little bit harder to follow. So I opted for the one-dimensional one. So here we have the C2 Higgs model in two dimensions. It's a fairly complicated beast. It has this gauge field with degrees of freedom that lives on the links, and it has this matter field with degrees of freedom that lives on the sides, and this cap there. You know already that this is dual to this tenitorical model. Now, this is the phase diagram of the Villain-Higgs model. It looks like that. It has Coulomb phase, a Higgs phase, a confinement, and etc. I didn't work that out. This is the work of Fradkin and Shekhar. Now, why does it look so symmetrical relative to the middle line? Because the model is not only has interesting duality, but it's also self-dual. It has the symmetry of the algebraic interaction that makes everything symmetrical relative to this line. Now, I didn't say that either. That was known as well. But now I can generalize this to groups that people haven't studied yet, but are studying now and making numerics. If I now generalize the degrees of freedom to take p values and study the CP Higgs model, I know I can show you, and that's new, that that model is self-dual as well. So the phase diagram has exactly the same symmetry as the phase diagram of C2 Higgs model. This is the kind of things you learn in complex phase diagrams. So this is the duality to the extended torical. And you see again that the gauge symmetry starts. I mean, everything generalizes. Julien Vidal is doing simulations of these CP torical models. And he will find the symmetry because they are self-dual. And that, to our knowledge, is new in the literature for P larger than 2.
Yeah. Well,
first, I haven't been able to reproduce this trick for non-abelian model. This trick of finding a dual without gauge symmetries.
It's a physical argument, right? You see,
So, okay. So let me put it this way. I have worked out some examples with SU2. And what I find, I do find duals, but they have a more gauge symmetry than the original instead of having less. Yeah. Which means that if you go back to the partition function or the path integral, you're going to maybe have local constraints or something like that. But you can use the mapping to find interesting topological degrees of freedom. And that's what we think is interesting.
I was reminded of this paper by which you referred to Nusinov and the optics.
There
the power of this method comes up. KTF solved his honeycomb lattice model.
Right.
Using this Majorana fermions, and finally he got C2 gauge theory of Majorana fermions.
Right.
Using on a honeycomb lattice. Now, I think the work is Nusinov paper shows that just by looking at bond algebra and rewriting it in terms of Clifford algebra.
Right.
You can get all these things.
Right.
So even without Kitteo, you could have solved the problem by this way. Can you elaborate on that? Because that was fairly straightforward, because it's an exactly solvable model.
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is that my contribution, perhaps my only contribution, besides all the work computing all the examples, was to realize that I had to consider associated algebras. Because in that paper, they were using only Lie algebras. And my contribution was to say, well, if I use Lie algebras, I cannot compute dual variables. So I need to extend to associated Lie algebras. So that's the first thing that comes to mind.
And also, the gauge thing was exact.
Right.
C2 gauge field was static. It was not average.
Mm-hmm.
And then it becomes a spin problem where there is no C2 gauge.
Right. I have this transparency, right? Yeah, this transparency. Right. This paper.
That's
the one. Yeah, this was first success of the approach.
can you tell in 1 minute about your dimensional reduction?
Dimensional reduction, yeah, sure. Of course, whoever wants to leave is free to leave. The dimensional reduction work is not as, it's rough around the edges. But yeah, I wanted to tell something about that for.
Yeah, what is the summary of that?
Right. Okay. Okay, so the basic idea about dimensional reduction is just that you have some system that it looks three-dimensional, for instance, but all the interesting physics may be happening on planes. High TC superconductivity is an example we love the most. So the superconductivity happens on planes. So ADS-CFT is a very famous example where there is this mapping that changes the dimension of things and things like that. So we would like to have some, I don't know, Gerardo, Soha, and I wanted to have like an approach to dimensional reduction that only used like very basic things, nothing too difficult. So first, what about exact dimensional reduction? Well, exact dimensional reduction is just a duality. If you think now about the interactions, you say, well, maybe, you know, the interactions have their own mind about what dimension is. They don't really know about the geometry of the lattice. They just know about algebra. So you may well have bone algebras that you can realize in lower dimensions. And that happens very often with models of topological quantum model. This is a three-dimensional example. The Professor Chamon proposed this model recently of topological quantum order in three dimensions. And Sergey Bravi studied it with lots of detail. But if you just look at the Born algebra, it's a one-dimensional model. And the thing is that the model is just the sum of all those operators that commute between each other. This is typical in this game. It's a completely commutative algebra. So what is the other thing that characterizes the algebra? Well, in this case, it's those two constraints. If the lattice is satisfies periodic boundary conditions, you can break up this FCC lattice into four sublattices, and the interaction terms in each the bonds in each sublattice multiply to one. And then again, you have to convince yourself that's all there is to the bond algebra. But once you convince yourself of that, you can show that the model is dual, no symmetry, no wedge symmetry, it's unitarily equivalent to four decoupled periodic Ising chains. That doesn't mean that the topological order is trivial, of course, because topological order is strongly linked to the representation and the symmetries you can construct in that representation. But it gives you a good way to compute correlators and stuff like that in this model. So this is the first thing, exact dimensional reduction. It's a focus on the interactions. The interactions know what dimension they can live in. So I can look for dualities and see if I can change the dimension that way. But that's fairly unusual. Well, these are some things you can do with dimensional reduction. To have dualities that change in the dimension is fairly unusual. It's difficult. So we would like to have a notion of approximate dimensional reduction. And what we propose, which is still a little bit rough around the edges, but we're working on it, is to use inequalities. Instead of looking for effective theories that are typically non-local, we look for effective theories that are local but only give you bounds on correlators in higher dimensions. And we try to argue that if those bounds are tight, then you have a good case for approximate dimensional reduction. And this is how to get those bounds in classical system. The difficult part is to do it in the quantum system because entanglement gets in the way. So you have to be ingenious about entanglement. But that would be a summary.